Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. I was born less than 20 years after the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we recently marked the grim 50th anniversary of those events. As a child, the fear of nuclear war was ever present as the Cold War was at its peak. But I was also fascinated with the science behind nuclear energy and the promise that it could be used for peaceful purposes, since the nuclear genie was definitely out of the bottle. Now, the crisis that causes me the most apprehension is what we're doing to our planetary climate with our addiction to fossil fuels. So when a new book about nuclear energy arrived in my mailbox, I was intrigued. After reading Tim Gregory's Going Nuclear, How Atomic Energy Will Save the World, I decided he'd be a great guest for our show. Tim's a fascinating person. He's a senior nuclear chemist at the United Kingdom Nuclear Laboratory at Sellafield, Cumbria. His previous book, Meteorite, The Stones from Outer Space That Made Our World, is a great scientific exploration of meteorite science and definitely puts his love of science and exploration on full display. He also took part in the BBC series Astronauts, Do You Have What It Takes? And he reached the final three out of thousands of applicants. Tim joins us now from his home in the beautiful and historic Cumbria region of Great Britain. Tim Gregory, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you for the invitation.
Tim, I'd like to know a bit about your background because it's very interesting to me. You got really interested in science early on. And geology kind of was your specialty. Tell me about going back to the very beginning. When was your first inklings that you really liked science?
Oh, you know, I'd love to be able to give a kind of an example of something that happened. Like I looked up at the moon one day and just realized, or looked, I don't know, under a rock and saw some insects and fell in love with science. But I honestly can't remember falling in love with science. It's always been there. It's just as far back as I can remember, and even before then. And I guess that love of science never really left me, which is why I became a scientist for my job.
And tell us about your background in geology, because you had some interesting things you'd study about rocks from space.
Yeah, so I did my undergraduate degree in geology, and it was in my third year. I actually did an internship over on your side of the pond. I spent the summer in Houston at the Johnson Space Center measuring the chemistry and looking at the geology of a meteorite that fell in Antarctica was discovered in Antarctica mm-hmm. in 1994. And it was then that I fell in love with the lab. That was really the first time that I'd spent any serious time in the lab with analytical instruments, which motivated me to do my PhD in isotope cosmochemistry, where I measured the age of the solar system using radioactive dating in rocks by measuring their elemental and crucially their isotopic composition. And that was really the period of my life where I always say that that's where I learned my trade as an analyst, because the same instruments that you can use to measure the composition of a meteorite, you can use the exact same instruments to measure the composition of nuclear fuel or nuclear medicine or nuclear forensic samples, whatever it might be. And so although I learned my trade as an analyst in cosmochemistry and space science, I still do very similar measurements now, just on a slightly different field. So it was more of a sideways career step into nuclear after my PhD in cosmochemistry.
And now you're a nuclear chemist in the British nuclear industry, right?
That's right. I work in a lab, and I'm really lucky as an analyst that I get to work pretty much across the full remit of nuclear science. I mean, of course, a large part of my job is working in nuclear power, measuring the composition of nuclear fuel before and after it's been in a reactor. But I also get to work in the fields of nuclear medicine. And I haven't entirely left the world of space behind either, because I do get to dabble in nuclear space exploration as well, because we've been using radioactive isotopes to power spacecraft for pretty much as long as there has been a space program.
Tell me just a little bit about what got you interested in writing a book about nuclear energy and why you think it's so important right now? Because I found this book to be very compelling and fascinating and, you know, challenging a lot of assumptions that people have about nuclear energy and the dangers of, you know, atomic energy. Tell us what motivated you to want to write this.
Yeah, sure. So it's funny because when I was 16, I had to do an assignment for school. It was a 5,000-word essay, which at the time felt like, I don't know, it just felt an impossibly long piece of writing. But I got to choose whatever topic I wanted. It was completely open-ended. And the topic that I chose was, how does nuclear power work? And will it save us? And so in some ways, I feel like my new book has been literally half my lifetime in the making, because I'm 32 now. So it was half my lifetime ago I wrote that essay. And so I've always had this kind of background interest in nuclear science and how it interfaces with society. And, you know, during the first couple of years after I left academia and the kind of cosmochemistry and started working in nuclear, I realized there are so many misconceptions out there about nuclear science, perhaps of all the branches of science that have the power to genuinely make the world a better place, and not just for human prosperity and economic growth, but crucially for environmental stewardship as well. And nuclear science is right up there with one of those subjects that has massive positive ramifications, but is so misunderstood. There's such a legacy of misunderstanding and fear and trepidation and mistrust. And so they were the primary motivations for me writing my new book. But of course, it's always nice to have an excuse to talk about science as well. So there's plenty of that in there too.
Yes, it's very cool. And you're about half my age, so you've lived a half life. There's a new nuclear joke for you.
There we go. Okay.
And I really like, in the beginning of the book, you do go through a nice history of unlocking the secrets of the atom. You know, with us discovering what the structure of an atom is. And then, of course, all that leads up to the World War II era and the atomic age. But were there some things that you kind of discovered when you were researching that maybe surprised you and that you thought were particularly interesting?
One of the biggest surprises, particularly with, you know, when I go through a very whistle-stop tour of the early history of nuclear science with the discovery of the nucleus, the discovery of nuclear reactions, the discovery of nuclear fission, was just how genuinely genius these early nuclear scientists were. I mean, it's difficult enough doing cool science now in the lab that I work in and my colleagues and collaborators work in, with all of the modern technology, with computers at our disposal. These were kind of, honestly, like in most cases, homemade pieces of scientific instrumentation, and using just things that you would just find lying around any normal lab, just cobbled together in these really smart ways. They managed to peer right down into the very heart of material reality and make these completely profound and, although they didn't know it at the time, but it turned out to be the case, world-changing discovery using the simplest of apparatus. Perhaps Rutherford was the person who encapsulated that the most. He was such a genius. And so definitely writing the first part of this book, going back and reading the original publications of how the atomic nucleus was discovered, how radioactivity was discovered. It was so beautifully, simply elegant the way that they did it. And so that was a real joy to read and kind of immerse myself in.
Yes, I'm very well versed and familiar with all of those stories. But for our listeners who aren't, I think it would be cool for you to explain the Rutherford experiment, because it really is quite a powerful experiment that really unlocked, you know, the heart of the atom.
It is. It was amazing. So Rutherford famously fired alpha particles.
Which are?
Gold. Alpha particles are small pieces of atomic nuclei. They're composed of two protons and two neutrons. And so in a nuclear sense, they are identical to the nucleus of a helium atom, a regular helium atom. That's element number two on the periodic table. And now and again, radioactive atoms spit out alpha particles, and they have incredible energy. Okay, they're very, very energetic, but because they're so large and so massive, they don't travel very far. Okay, we say that they're very low penetrating radiation, so just a couple of centimeters of air will easily block an alpha particle dead in its tracks. And I can attest to this personally, because I use a Geiger counter every day at work. And if I've got some uranium, for example, which is an alpha emitter, and I've got the Geiger counter even an inch away from the sample, it doesn't detect anything. You have to almost be touching the sample to detect alpha particles, because they get blocked very easily. And so Rutherford was firing these alpha particles at some gold foil. And the gold foil was incredibly, incredibly, incredibly thin, just a couple of atoms thick, this almost like tinfoil, but even thinner, made from gold. And to his complete astonishment and surprise, he found that some of these alpha particles would bounce and be deflected in a complete 180 away from the gold leaf. There's the famous metaphor that he used to describe this. It was like firing a bullet at tissue paper and it bouncing right back, it recoiling. And by measuring the number of alpha particles that bounced back, I mean, this was painstaking work, and actually much of it was done under a microscope as well, because, you know, this was really small, careful science. By measuring the number of alpha particles that bounced back from his gold leaf, he deduced that the only explanation was that right in the center of a gold atom, and by extension all atoms, there's an incredibly dense positive charge that the alpha particle approaches, it's repelled by and then sent straight back in the opposite direction. And we now know that this dense positive charge at the center of the atom is the atomic nucleus. And so it was Rutherford that discovered the atomic nucleus, and it was that discovery, amongst a couple of other key discoveries, that led eventually to the discovery and the implementation of nuclear fission.
And it's fascinating to think about the structure of an atom with the nucleus at the center, you know, surrounded by the electron clouds. That most of an atom is really nothing.
It's completely crazy, isn't it?
It is so strange.
Yeah, I remember learning that as a teenager, I guess I would have been, and I couldn't get my head around
it's
it.
Mostly empty around, space.
Yeah, I'm looking around my office now at my desk in front of me.
And if we could just drop a neutron through my desk, just a single neutron, it'd just go right through it, probably.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, isn't it?
Unreal.
It doesn't seem very empty, but I still don't really think I've fully got my head around that. You know, like there are some things in like astronomy, when you think about like the number of stars in the Milky Way, and you can't comprehend it. Atoms are like that, but just in the opposite sense.
Yeah. Well, let's move forward to, you know, World War II. The atomic bombs are dropped and the nuclear age begins, the atomic age. And so paralleling that with the atomic weapons and the Cold War and arms race, you have, you know, the United States, Soviet Union, and other countries developing nuclear weapons and producing them at an alarming clip. But you also have, paralleling that, nuclear power and atoms for peace. Tell us about the first nuclear reactor, because it's kind of a neat story.
Yeah, it's amazing. So the first nuclear reactor was in the early 40s in Chicago, and that was Enrico Fermi and his team who got that working. And that was really just to demonstrate that you could actually get uranium to chain react in a nuclear reaction. You could sustain fission reactions in a chain reaction. And if it were possible to do it in a reactor, then at least in principle, it was possible to do it with an atomic weapon as well. And so the first nuclear reactor, early 1940s, that was in a military setting. But like you said, after World War II finished, we'd just gone through this revolution in nuclear physics and nuclear chemistry. We understood so much more about the atomic nucleus, about the kind of things that they could do. We'd learn how to synthesize and purify large amounts of plutonium, a brand new element that was first synthesized and characterized during the Manhattan Project as well. We'd really undergone a revolution. The next question is, how do we use this science? And Atoms for Peace was this idea that we can use nuclear science for the betterment of humankind, not just for energy, although that was the major pillar, but also for things like agriculture and space exploration as well. And it's really cool because, you know, as with the claim to be the first anything, it's often complicated. History tells a complicated story, and people make competing claims, and these things honestly happen iteratively. And so often claims to be the first anything, unless it's like the first person on the moon, which is pretty unambiguous, claims to be the first nuclear power station, it's a kind of judgment call. But at least the line that I draw, and this is kind of widely accepted, is that the world's first commercial nuclear power station was here in the UK, actually. It was opened in 1957. Yay. And it was called Calder Hall. And it's actually on the site where I work. And so I see Calder Hall every day.
Oh, that's
actually
so cool. Although,
yeah, it's amazing. And Queen Elizabeth II, well, she was a young lady back then. She opened it. And there's footage on the internet. You can still see it. She's got that lovely old-fashioned clipped accent that she used to speak in back in the 50s. And she opened Calder Hall. And that really marked the point at which nuclear science jumped the divide between the military application and the domestic application, because for the first time, nuclear electricity was entering the grid commercially, and it was being used to do all the cool things like spin washing machines and vinyl records like they had back then, and maybe some people still do. So it was in 1957, and it started proliferating thereafter. But it was really during the 1970s that the kind of the world capacity for nuclear power started going up rapidly. And that was in large part driven in North America with the rollout of the North American fleet. It was absolutely enormous. And it's still today the biggest nuclear fleet in the world in the USA, which is amazing considering that so few reactors have been connected to the grid since the late 70s. It was such a brief period where loads of nuclear reactors were being built.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our look at the past, present, and future of nuclear energy with British scientist and author Tim Gregory. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with British scientist and author Tim Gregory as we discuss his new book, Going Nuclear: How Atomic Energy Will Save the World. Explain to us how a nuclear power plant that generates electricity, how it works. What is the process that actually makes electricity from nuclear energy?
Yeah, sure. So it's really simple in principle. The whole name of the game is to heat water and boil it. And by boiling water, you generate steam, and using the steam, you can turn a turbine. And that turbine essentially turns a magnet inside a coil of wire that pushes electrons through the wire and into the grid. And so the whole name of the game is making water warm. And of course, most of the electricity in the world is generated by this means, but using fossil fuels instead of nuclear fuel. But the whole point is just to make water warm. Now, with a nuclear reactor, you make the water warm by splitting atoms in a chain reaction. And so the idea is you have fuel rods that are made from uranium. That uranium is normally enriched in the light isotope, uranium-235, which if you just dug your regular uranium out of the ground, only 0.7% of those atoms would be uranium-235. And that's a bit of a problem because it's uranium-235 that chain reacts. It's fissile. It's kind of the heart and soul of a nuclear reactor. And so we normally enrich that uranium to a couple of percent, 3 or 4, maybe 5% maximum kind of thing for a nuclear reactor. And once we've increased the percentage of the fissile isotope, uranium-235, is ready to chain react. And the cool thing about uranium-235 is when the nucleus bursts open, not only does it release a lot of energy, but it releases more neutrons as well. And if the reactor is constructed in such a way that those neutrons have an opportunity to hit other atoms of uranium, those neutrons will split those atoms too, which will release more neutrons. Those neutrons will hit other atoms that will release more neutrons, and so on and so on and so forth in a nuclear chain reaction that once started will sustain itself. And so I kind of liken nuclear reactors to giant whistling kettles. The whole name of the game is to generate steam, and we generate that steam by splitting atoms that warms water.
And the water that's used in these reactors is also very important. Tell us about the type of water that's ideal to use in a nuclear reactor.
Right. So one of the problems when uranium-235 splits is those neutrons are traveling incredibly quickly, okay? And these so-called fast neutrons, they tend not to interact with uranium-235. And so before it has an opportunity to hit another uranium atom, split it open, we have to slow it down. And we do this using a material called a neutron moderator. And all a moderator does is it just slows a neutron down. That makes it more likely to split an atom that it happens upon. And the way that most reactors in the world get around this is by enriching the uranium, okay? They enrich the uranium to provide more targets for the neutrons, but there are some types of reactor that use a really special type of water called heavy water. Now, water, H2O, the H is really important because there is another type of hydrogen as opposed to regular hydrogen that's slightly heavier, okay? We call it deuterium.
It's got a neutron, yeah.
That's right. It's got an extra neutron in its nucleus. And it turns out that deuterium is a fantastic neutron moderator. And so if you flood your nuclear reactor with heavy water, you don't have to enrich the uranium. It will run on uranium dug straight from the ground. And this is the basis for Canada's nuclear reactors. Canada essentially invented the heavy water reactor. You don't need to enrich the uranium. You just have to flood the core of the reactor with heavy water. So that's one way to do it. You either enrich the uranium to send the reactor critical, or you moderate the neutrons really effectively using heavy water. Either works, and both are actually pretty successful and widespread across the global fleet.
I recall from your book that the Canadian reactor had an interesting name term. What was that?
The Canadian reactor is called the CANDU reactor.
Right, the CANDU.
Yeah, yeah, which stands for Canada Deuterium Uranium Reactor. I'm not sure if that was actually a pun, though. I like to think it was a pun because CANDU kind of sounds like positive and upbeat. But I guess that's very Canadian.
Electricity CANDU.
Yeah, yeah, it's brilliant. So, and that type of reactor is also used widely in India. Uh-huh. For example, so it's really Canada and India that are into their CANDU reactors, which are cool.
And then, as you mentioned, we have this initial wave of nuclear reactors being built, especially, you know, here in the United States. Growing up here in California, I remember we had the San Onofre reactor down at San Clemente in Southern California, and the Diablo Canyon reactor just north of Los Angeles that I remember seeing on many a hike in the coastal mountains. So, you know, nuclear reactors were just kind of part of life back in the 60s and 70s, in the 70s. And then, of course, Three Mile Island happens. And as you put it, that we go through kind of a dark age of, you know, reactor building where there's just not much activity. Tell us about those waves of reactors and how Three Mile Island affected things.
Yeah, it's astonishing that more nuclear reactors were built in the 5 years leading up to Three Mile Island than have been built since. And so it really, really is no exaggeration to say that Three Mile Island in 1979 ended the nuclear power expansion in North America, which is even more astonishing considering that nobody died in Three Mile Island and no members of the public or indeed the workforce at the power station were exposed to anything more than background radiation. It was really a PR disaster rather than a nuclear disaster. But globally, the expansion of nuclear power continued, but as North America kind of fell away and fell out of love with nuclear power, I guess, it was really Europe that took the charge, particularly in France. The 1980s were completely dominated by nuclear power reactors being built in Europe, including the UK as well. But like Three Mile Island in 79, we had our own nuclear accident in 1986. We had Chernobyl. And again, you see the same thing. Europe built more nuclear reactors in the 5 years leading up to Chernobyl than it has built since. And so just as Three Mile Island spelled an end to nuclear power expansion in North America, Chernobyl put an end to nuclear power expansion in Europe, and it massively dropped off through the 90s and the 2000s.
Well, we need to talk about Chernobyl is the title of one of your chapters. So let's do that.
Yes.
Because I found it really interesting, you know, what I thought I knew about Chernobyl and what you portrayed in your book. It's kind of two different pictures.
For sure. So it's really difficult because I really don't want to diminish what happened at Chernobyl because it was terrible and it was also avoidable. It was ultimately the consequence of a weird reactor design and corrupt Soviet leadership. So these reactors, you have two choices. You can either enrich the uranium to get your reactor critical, or you can put a really good neutron moderator in the core that slows those neutrons down to get your reactor critical. You most reactors do one or the other. The reactors at Chernobyl were a very strange type that did both. They had enriched uranium, and their cores were full of graphite as well. And graphite, like heavy water, is a really, really good neutron moderator. And so it was a very strange reactor design that had enriched uranium and graphite in the core and water. They were running a safety test at the time, the engineers at Chernobyl. They completely flaunted the rules and the regulations of how to run the reactor. And it culminated in an explosion. And it's important to note that it wasn't a nuclear explosion. The reactor at Chernobyl did not explode like a nuclear bomb. It was a regular chemical explosion. The core essentially overheated and flashed and caused a hydrogen explosion. And then the graphite inside the reactor set on fire and the surrounding buildings set on fire. And it lofted radioactive particles high into the atmosphere that actually spread all over the Northern Hemisphere. I mean, I wasn't alive at the time, but there are people working at my place of work. I mean, you can imagine my lab's full of radiation detectors that can detect absolutely minute amounts of radiation. And it was even detectable here in the UK. And it was detectable all across Europe and as far as America as well. And so the fire lofted motes of dust into the sky and spread them around the Northern Hemisphere. Now, as for the fatalities, again, I don't want to diminish them because they were all avoidable. However, it's important to look at these things rationally when we think about the future of nuclear power and ask the question, is it worth it? Because if it does turn out that nuclear power, I mean, kills like millions and millions of people, we might want to think twice about implementing it. But luckily, as you can imagine, Chernobyl kind of acts as this very unfortunate, but in some ways, this kind of natural experiment of what happens when a nuclear reactor explodes and sets on fire and exposes people to radiation. This has been forensically studied for decades. And how can I put it? It's not like some sort of cover-up job. The consortium of scientists that study this basically spans the entire world and includes scientists from the affected countries as well. It's a little bit like the IPCC reports that come out on climate change, where it's this kind of this going through the scientific literature and arriving at consensus internationally. That's been done with Chernobyl. And when you look at the number of fatalities, it's something in the mid-30s that died as a direct consequence in the immediate aftermath. And they were mostly first responders. So, for example, the people who were on shift at the power plant at the time of the accident, and famously the firefighters as well that were first on scene to put out the fires. About 35 of them died from radiation poisoning. Now, it's important to look at the latent deaths amongst the wider population as well. And it's very surprising, given the mythic reputation of the night in question, that there was no measurable increase in any kind of cancer amongst the affected populations, with the exception of thyroid cancer. That affected people who were children at the time of Chernobyl. And that was because of a very particular isotope that you find in nuclear reactors. It's a radioactive isotope of iodine. And iodine, I mean, you can take it as a health supplement, can't you? You can kind of take it as a daily supplement if you're into that kind of thing. And iodine accumulates in your thyroid in the same way that calcium accumulates in your bones and your teeth. Iodine accumulates in your thyroid. And so if you ingest radioactive iodine, that radioactive iodine will get soaked up by your thyroid just the same way that regular non-radioactive iodine will get soaked up as well. And so people in the affected populations, they were exposed to this radioactive iodine. It went into their thyroids. And amongst people who were children and adolescents at the time, there is a measurable excess in the rates of thyroid cancer amongst that population. Fortunately, the survival rates for thyroid cancer are very high. They can be like 98, 99%. And so by combining these excess thyroid cancer rates with the survival rates for thyroid cancer, we can make some, you know, order of magnitude rough estimates of the death toll of Chernobyl. And doing these kind of estimates, it yields a couple of hundred deaths, something like that, amongst the wider population. And again, I don't want to diminish those deaths because these cases shouldn't have happened, the accident shouldn't have happened. But it's not that many considering the mythic reputation of the knight in question, because I had this perception once upon a time that, you know, thousands and thousands, maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of people died from cancer from Chernobyl. The truth is much less scary. It was probably far less than 1,000.
Wow. And it's interesting to consider, you know, you had that accident and then more recently in 2011, Fukushima in Japan after the earthquake. And we just had another earthquake similar to that last night in the Kamchatka Peninsula that sent tsunami waves across the Pacific. Nothing bad, but it did happen. And you kind of detail what happened there too, that, you know, that was a really, what a strange combination of things that happened that caused that reactor to explode.
It was. So it was an absolutely enormous earthquake off the coast of Japan, sent a tsunami hurtling towards Japan's coast. And the Fukushima power station was inundated with ocean water from the tsunami. And actually multiple reactors went into meltdown simultaneously, and three of them exploded. There was no fire like there was at Chernobyl, but of course, like a nuclear reactor exploding is a pretty serious thing to happen. But interestingly, in the aftermath of Fukushima, there has been one death that has been tied directly to radiation. Even that death is actually contested in the scientific literature. It's still not actually certain whether that single death was caused by radiation or would have happened anyway. It was a case of lung cancer from someone who worked at the power station. But nonetheless, at least one person died, or rather at most one person died from the nuclear accident at Fukushima. But interestingly, because of the massive evacuation from the surrounding area, more than 2,000 people died from the stress of being displaced during the evacuation. And most of the people that died in the evacuation were old people, because they were displaced from their homes, they were displaced from care homes, from hospitals. And there is an argument to be made that evacuating the area around a nuclear power station where several of the reactors have gone into meltdown and a few of them have exploded, there's a good argument that that's a good idea as a precautionary measure. However, when you look at the amount of radiation that the affected populations would have been exposed to, it was slightly elevated compared to background radiation in Japan, but it was still far less than many countries receive naturally in the world. So, for example, Finland has quite a large background radiation because of the uranium-rich bedrocks. Colorado, not a country, of course, a state, but Colorado has quite high background radiation because of a combination of uranium-rich ground rocks and very high altitude, gets exposed to a lot of cosmic rays. The radiation doses in most of the areas that were evacuated around Fukushima were far less than these places. And so this overreaction, this kind of knee-jerk reaction to exposure to radiation of any level actually killed more people than the radiation did in the end, which was really unfortunate and avoidable. Although, you know, not to be too harsh on the Japanese authorities, they were dealing with one of the worst earthquakes in Japanese history at the time. And so that has to be factored in too. But
it's massive.
It's kind of one of the points that I try and make throughout my book, is that the fear of radiation and the way that it negatively affects our perception and our implementation of nuclear power is actually worse than radiation itself. There's this amazing statistic that if you live a couple of miles away from a nuclear power station, the amount of radiation you're exposed to annually is about the same as you get from eating a banana. And bananas are slightly radioactive because of the slight amounts of potassium-40 that they naturally contain. Yeah, it's about the same as a banana.
Oh, that's funny.
And so even when you add up all of the deaths from Chernobyl, you include all of the deaths from Fukushima. If you look at the entire, basically 70-year history of nuclear power generation globally, you find that more people die every couple of hours from fossil fuel air pollution than have ever died of nuclear power. And so rather than being this kind of uncontrollable, dangerous, reckless thing, actually splitting atoms in nuclear power stations is one of the safest things that humanity does. And we will be far better doing that than setting fire to fossil fuels.
After a short break, we'll be back for more as we visit with Tim Gregory. Tim is a senior nuclear scientist at the United Kingdom's National Nuclear Laboratory and the author of the new book, Going Nuclear: How Atomic Energy Will Save the World. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we examine the issues surrounding nuclear power as a way to achieve net zero carbon emissions with British scientist and author Tim Gregory. It's just astonishing to me that we know that climate change is happening despite what the U.S. government is saying right now, which is ridiculous. We know we need to solve it. I'd like you to just take a moment, not too long, but there's this perception out there that, oh, we can solve this problem with renewables. We've got solar, we've got wind, biofuels, blah, blah, blah. There's some serious environmental costs to those things that usually aren't discussed that you do in your book.
Yes, for sure. So, of course, lots of people are worried about climate change, and rightly so. But by focusing on climate change and carbon emissions, we miss the bigger picture. There is far more to consider when it comes to the environment. So take land use, for example. Every form of power generation uses some land. So whether it be the fields that you cover in solar panels or the land that you cover in wind turbines, or crucially, and this is what we often forget, especially in the developed world, we forget the mines that we have to dig to exhume the minerals from which we make renewable power sources. They're a long way away from the infamous my backyard, okay? They're kind of out of sight and out of mind for certainly people across Europe and North America as well. But these mines are huge. They consume massive amounts of land. And so by taking into account the full land use of a power source, and by comparing that to the amount of energy that we get, we can compare sources like for like when it comes to things like land intensity, which of course is a really important environmental consideration. And it turns out that nuclear is the most energy dense way to generate power. It uses the least amount of land of any way that we can generate electricity. And that's good because not only do we get the power that we need, but we get it by using less land, which means there's more space for nature. There's more space for biodiversity. There's more space for reforestation. There's more space for the kind of landscapes that we all enjoy. I mean, I was just in the States a couple of months ago with my wife. We were newlyweds. We were on our honeymoon.
And congratulations.
Thank you very much. And the landscapes that you have out there are just absolutely beautiful. We were driving through Arizona and Utah visiting the national parks. And sometimes it's, especially with, you know, writing a book on nuclear power and talking about it all the time, it's sometimes easy to miss the wood for the trees. The point really isn't nuclear power as an end in itself. The point is nuclear power to achieve the end that we want. And that end is lots of energy with minimal impact on the natural environment. And renewables are great. They don't emit carbon dioxide, but they're not great for the environment by every metric. So we've talked about land. Another one is mineral intensity, the mass of minerals that you need to generate a megawatt hour of solar power, for example, is far more than you need to generate a megawatt hour of nuclear power. We can think about the amount of rock that you have to mine. So that's the mining intensity of energy sources. We can also think about how this all rolls together for the ecological impact. Nuclear power has the least ecological impact of any power source. And this is not kind of like nuclear power industry propaganda. This is peer-reviewed literature that's out there for anybody to read. And so it's very, very interesting when you widen the picture and consider more of the environmental consequences aside from carbon emissions, which of course are very important. Renewables don't look so green when you take that into consideration.
And you make the statement that we cannot achieve net zero without nuclear power.
No, absolutely not. And all the environmental considerations aside, I mean, it would be great if we could completely replace fossil fuels with wind turbines and solar panels. But unfortunately, not only do they not produce the amount of power that we need to sustain society as we enjoy it and sustain society as the developing world is heading towards, they have a very crucial flaw, which of course is the intermittence, the unreliability. But of course, wind turbines don't work when it's not windy, and solar panels don't work during the nighttime, and they're vastly diminished on cloudy days. And there are all these solutions that people tout as to how we might solve that problem. So people talk about batteries, for example. Even the best batteries that we've got at the moment, they might get you through a couple of hours if you've got one in your garage outside hooked up to your solar panels, but grid scale storage is measured in minutes and hours. And that's at the best case. And so to think that they can compensate for renewables that can falter for days and weeks at a time is to my mind, ludicrous. And so renewables are great. They can kind of get you going on the long road towards phasing out fossil fuels, but they're not going to do it on their own. You need something reliable that can spring in during times of low generation. And my argument is that's nuclear. That's where nuclear comes in.
Can I interrupt and ask a quick question? Because my biggest concern for a nuclear power grid is the long-term viability, because it seems that these power plants only last 40, 60, 80, maybe 100 years. So just looking in the long-term future, you know, humanity has been around for a very long time, and I'd like it to be for a really long time. What do we do?
Me too.
What do we do with 1,000 years of nuclear power plants that have been deactivated?
You correctly pointed out that nuclear power stations last for 40, 60, 80 years. That's actually a really, really long time for any power source. So wind turbines and solar panels typically last 20, 25 years, something like that, which isn't very long. So for a nuclear power station, I mean, most of the power stations now in North America are like half a century old. Some of them have had their licenses extended to 80 years. This is one of the reasons why they've got such a low environmental footprint. Once they're built, they don't actually take much running, and they are comparatively cheap to run once they're built as well. Now, one of the things that people always ask me about, and I read so much about this from all sides of the debate, is of course nuclear waste.
Yes.
So it's undeniable that nuclear power stations produce nuclear waste. And when people say nuclear waste, it's really the spent fuel, because that contains almost all of the radioactivity of nuclear waste. And so what starts life as this relatively unradioactive uranium fuel, once it's spent, is this kind of witch's brew of short-lived fission fragments that decay with a half-life of 30 years all the way up to plutonium that will remain radioactive for the best part of 1 million years. And so the question is, what do you do with it? And this problem has been solved by none other than Finland.
Finland.
Yeah, good old Finland.
The hiding place.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
They get nearly half of their electricity from nuclear. It's actually, by percentage, one of the most nuclear nations on the planet. Mm. And 40 years ago, they decided that they were going to dispose of their nuclear waste underground. They were essentially going to bury it. The idea being that if you put nuclear waste underground for long enough, that radioactivity will diminish, and eventually it won't be nuclear waste anymore. It will just be waste, because like all radioactive objects, nuclear waste becomes less radioactive over time. And so 40 years ago, they started scouring Finland for a suitable place, because the geology has to be right. And they went on a big public information and education campaign as well, to kind of ask the public what they thought about it, reassure them, keep them in the loop with all of their plans. And just last year, they finally finished it and started using it. It's called Onkalo. And Onkalo is miles and miles of tunnels that were burrowed into the hard, impermeable, crystalline Finnish bedrock. And there's enough space down there for all of Finland's nuclear waste now and for the remaining lifetime of their current nuclear reactors, which as I said, produce about half of Finland's power, just less than half of Finland's power, something like that. And so they've designed and successfully implemented this geological storage solution. And you know, this is where the geologist in me comes out, because it only has to stay down there for about 1 million years. And to most people, saying only 1 million years sounds completely ridiculous.
Blink of the eye to the planet.
Exactly. On a geological timescale,
human.
1 million years is barely anything. It will come and go. And so Finland have shown that it's possible not only to find somewhere and win the public over, but also to design, build, and implement it. And there are about a dozen other countries around the world now that are searching for their own place to put a geological repository, the UK amongst them, and France as well.
But what about still the sites of the actual power plants? Can those sites, again, I'm thinking of 1,000, 2,000 years of making a new nuclear power plant every, say, 80 or even 100 years if we extend the life. Are those sites going to be viable?
Yes.
Or are we going to start having, yes, they can be reused, those sites?
Yes, definitely. They could be reused. Once the nuclear reactor has kind of reached the end of its lifetime, whether it's 60 years or 80 years, there's no reason why it couldn't be taken out and a new one put in on exactly the same site. There's no reason that we shouldn't do that. You know, if your engine blows in your car, you don't have to get a new car. You can put a new engine or a new clutch in or whatever it is. There's no reason that we can't reuse the sites where we currently have nuclear power stations to put future nuclear power stations there. But even if we didn't decide to do that, you've got to remember, people go to work in these buildings all the time. It's not the buildings themselves that are the hazards, and the buildings don't become radioactive and the ground beneath them doesn't become radioactive just because there's a nuclear reactor there. The nuclear material and the radiation is contained inside the reactor vessel. And so there's no reason that you couldn't, I mean, I don't know why you would want to, with the mind to replacing fossil fuels. If you wanted to shut down a nuclear power station, there's no reason you couldn't fully dismantle it, get rid of it, and plant a forest there, for example. There's no reason you couldn't do that.
Okay. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about some kind of cool stuff in your book about radiation. There are some really fun things in there about gardening and seeds and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe touch on a couple of those cool uses for radiation.
Yeah, sure. So one of my favorites is atomic gardening. So it's very interesting because basically everything that we eat today has been genetically modified through selective breeding. Now, this is a slow process because we have to rely on natural mutations, just the ones that happen naturally all the time. But we can speed them up using radiation. And it sounds completely crazy, but scientists started doing this way back in the 50s. They started showering seeds and cuttings with intense fields of radiation. And I'm talking like absolutely enormous quantities of radiation, like many thousands of times more radiation than you would receive naturally. And so many of these plants perished, but some of them survived, and some of those had genetic mutations, which meant that when you plant the seed or you propagate the cutting, it's a little different to the parent plant. And many of these traits were useless or indeed detrimental, but now and again, they would stumble across a mutation that was favorable. So, for example, you could, by chance, breed a crop that doesn't need as much water to grow. They've bred crops that don't need as much fertilizer. Again, much better for the environment. They've bred crops that have higher yields. Again, better for the environment because you get more crop per hectare of land. They've even managed to breed crops, and this is really cool, that are hail resistant. And this practice of atomic gardening is really well documented by the International Atomic Energy Agency in the Mutant Variety Database, which doesn't sound real, but it is. You can go and browse it yourself. And there are more than 3,000 entries into this database, and they're growing on every continent in the world, apart from Antarctica. And one of my favorite examples of atomic gardening is barley. No surprises that the scientists who irradiated barley were British. And drinking beer, of course, is one of our favorite pastimes when we're not drinking tea. This barley sometimes acquires better malting properties, which makes it perfect for brewing. So I'll raise a glass to those gamma rays any day in the beer garden or the atomic garden.
Well, there was also a cool thing about radiating rhino horns to make them, you know, non-useful for people so that, you know, the poachers wouldn't be going after the rhino horns. I like that. But you close the book out with something that's always been important to me, is the exploration of the outer solar system and the solar system itself. It wouldn't be possible without using nuclear power. All of our great spacecraft, the Voyager spacecraft, Cassini, Galileo, the Viking landers on Mars, the Apollo missions left little tiny radioactive power plants on the moon that power experiments. It's for the long-term exploration of space, nuclear power is very important, isn't it?
It is, yeah, absolutely. Solar panels don't work very well beyond the orbit of Jupiter. And so to keep a spacecraft alive, the only option that we have is little nuclear space batteries. And like you said, it's Voyager, the Curiosity rover, the Perseverance rover, and in a very nice poetic twist, New Horizons as well, which explored Pluto. which is nice because Pluto is the planet that we give to the name of the element that made all of this possible.
Plutonium.
Exactly, yeah. And so without these nuclear space batteries, we wouldn't have been able to explore anywhere beyond the orbit of Jupiter.
Well, Tim Gregory, the author of Going Nuclear, How Atomic Energy Will Save the World, it was a delight to talk to you. Fascinating book, fascinating topic, and very important. Thanks for joining us to discuss this.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to our guest, British nuclear chemist Tim Gregory. You can get his new work, recently published in the United States by Pegasus Books, Going Nuclear, How Atomic Energy Will Save the World, at most major booksellers or order it at your local bookstore. You can check out Tim's website at tim-gregory.co.uk. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.